everybody. I'm Angela Bermudez.
I'm Austin. This is Brushes and Keys. And this time we're doing something a little different, although we plan to do this a bunch more times.
Yes.
This, we're doing a kind of quasi-interview slash hang and chat with another artist to just kind of talk about life, learn some about him. This was Jim McKenzie, a sculptor, painter, animator, many things.
And this is Make It Three. Here we are.
Yes.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here.
We're doing our first, you're the kickoff of this. You're our inaugural sort of third coffee slash, in my case, water.
Yeah, I also am
compatriot
shifting to water today.
Oh, okay. Hydrated.
Makes us both seem so healthy. I guzzle coffee 24/7. So I'm with you in spirit, but I'm trying to be slightly tempered. So I promise this is not going to be interviewee, but why don't you, if you don't mind, give us a little kind of rundown on who you are. What is your background?
Just a wall I got behind me. I got a nice logo for those who can't see.
Appreciate it. Yes. An excellent background.
So yeah, I guess I'm a sculptor. People know me as a sculptor, but really I do a lot of commercial stuff, animation, directing, and fun stuff like that. But I guess really most of my time is spent with my kid, my wife, and on downtime, I make ridiculous things. If you can't, this is a carrot.
Most of your time, you're with your family?
Yes, and very little.
That's
time.
Actually mind blowing.
Oh, is it?
Yes. Yeah, I know. I picture you all the time in the studio, you know, like just working.
Oh, no. I'm with my kid all the time.
I'm actually pretty surprised by that also. Because
really?
You have the vibe of a negligent father, but because you just have the vibe of someone who's always, maybe it's the biasing impact of social media, but it always feels like you are sharing new things.
Yeah, you're here.
And they have to be made at some point.
That's true. Yeah. I usually share way far in the future. So I'll do something and then like months later I'll share it and be like, hey, this is what I did. Some show about Play-Doh, which was like a year ago or whatever. But it's crazy going from, you know, working all the time just by yourself and then having a kid and, you know, waking up and taking them to school, taking them back, playing with them all day. And you have to find little pockets of time to do the ridiculous stuff that you do, because there's really no good money in art. And as some people might know, selling art is not, you know, it's not a thing really, unless
we'll call it sporadic.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, to find pockets of time to do actual commercial work, to you know, work on prints and stuff like that. You have to plan out every hour of the day pretty much.
So do you, out of not to just go straight into the weeds, because I really want to, you know, I really want to go back in time and work out how one discovers sculpting as a kid, you know, because that's a fairly novel one. But before I transition there, I want to just know in literal hours, like if we accept that you're sleeping for 8 hours a day, that's a gross overestimate in my case, but yeah. But let's just take 8 hours off of the 24-hour clock for argument's sake. Okay. If 16 hours is your given window to work with, you're saying the majority of that is work, but what would that actual breakdown be? Like, is it you could fit an hour or two of work? Because I'm actually just so mind blown by the idea that most of your time is not working. I need to know the
what's your secret
specifics. Oh. Well, maybe that also, because I can just see Angela going, so wait, it's possible for you to spend more time at home, is it?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to answer to that later.
Pretty much from, you know, 6:37 to about 9:30, 10 with my kid. He goes to school. Pick him back up at, you know, from like 5 to 11 o'clock at night. I'm with him again.
That still sounds like it kind of times out to 9 to 5 ish.
I don't really stop working until like 11, and then 11 to 5 with weird breaks in the middle. And, you know, you have lunch, which really screws you up. So you really have like an hour in the morning to do something before lunch happens and coffee. And then you have about like 3 hours after that. And then you have to get dinner and quickly get your son. So, you know, each day it's like, oh, what am I going to do within that little block of time? And, but everyone's different. You know, there's some people that really get a lot crammed in their day. And, right. You know, I try my best, but it's intense. Yeah. So
I remember a few years ago coming across one of these classical music, like I think it was Classic FM, which is one of the big radio stations in the UK that does classical music, and they have a fairly strong social media presence, and they published this chart based on like historical analysis, how much of the day a bunch of famous composers in history had actually spent writing music on a given day.
Oh, cool.
And it was actually very similar to what you're saying. It was shocking how little time some of the great, like the Mozarts and the Beethovens and the Brahms and the biggest names that you can think of. It would be like an hour in the morning, and then they would just kind of dick around and not do anything. And then at 7 o'clock at night, they'd start again and work until midnight or whatever. And then that was it. Each one of them was very different. Some were morning, some were afternoon, but almost none of them, with a couple exceptions, were basically like morning to, sunrise to sunset, just cranking. And that shocked me because a few of them are so prolific that it just, because I can write music pretty quickly, but it made me realize they must write on a whole other level of speed to have left behind the body of work that they did and spend so little of their time writing music. So anyway, I'm always interested in delegation of time.
I guess the coffee consumption.
Well, how much do you
still spend? Helps?
Oh, yeah. I need coffee a certain amount of hours in between. And
right.
Yeah. I have a whole wall. You can't see it now, but behind this, there's the entire wall is filled with, because me and Charlie's my studio mate. And we go to Starbucks around like 12 and 1 every day. And before that, so, you know, the little sticker on the Starbucks,
right.
The little freaking thing. Every time I get it, I peel it off and I stick it to the wall. And we were trying to like see how many we could get each. And he stopped at 5. And I had like hundreds of Starbucks things. And
oh my God.
I'm like such an asshole for wasting all this money.
Are you making like a new paper mache wall?
Yes.
Made of sugar.
It's disgusting. Because I
can just buy it. Like, yeah, it feels like it's definitely a piece emerging of some kind.
Yeah.
That's funny.
It's terrible.
I something I wanted to ask, because obviously I can see your studio and all the stuff you have. I know that some people, the environment is very important. Like if the place feels too cramped, they have to clean up. Like they don't want to see anything on the walls. For example, Austin, he can't have stuff around because it's distracting for him. Mm-hmm. How does that,
that's hypothetically true, but it's also poorly executed in practice right
actually,
now. I have an accordion looks, on the floor.
It looks pretty clean.
Yeah, you got your accordion.
Yeah. Compared to some other days, mm-hmm. but yeah.
Yeah, no, I think environment's very important. And it's almost like nest building. Like you have to make a little home for yourself wherever you are. And I've had so many home studios my entire life. You know, in the kitchen, in the bedroom, over here, over there.
Is this the first studio that you have separate from home?
This is my first studio ever that's not in my house. We've been here for about a year and a half now, or 2 years, actually.
It's pretty new.
And all I've made was this potato. I don't know if you could see the potato
yes.
for me. And I spent 2 years making this one potato on it. Oh, my commercials, God. But like,
I just want to point out that Jim is maker of potatoes and carrots, and that makes me so happy.
She loves vegetables.
That's like our, like literally, it's just, just like, I don't know why. Yeah, I call myself potato, Austin is a carrot. And ever since we know each other, that was it. That's why I mentioned on social media, wow, that's a portrait of Austin made by Jim.
Oh, that's right.
Uh-huh. Some people got that because that was like an inner joke.
Uh-huh.
They were laughing. But yeah, that's Austin.
It literally was like 6 years ago we met and she didn't know. We were initially just friends through, we met through Twitter and we were close friends for a year and change or something like that. Mm-hmm. Year and a half, I can't remember. But when we finally met in person to do a performance together, she hadn't realized how tall I was until I walked up to her, basically, and I was like way taller than her.
Wow.
And so she just kind of spontaneously was like, you're like a carrot. And it just never stuck. It was one of those things that, like, as the years have gone on and she's made little kind of like, she'll make like a sticker of us, and right. It's a potato and a carrot. And it's just one of those that just was there from the beginning for no reason, just completely off the cuff, but now is sort of ingrained to the point that there's even other people that will have picked up on it, which, yeah, is major stuff, quite hilariously apt.
For the thumbnail of this video, you're going to have to modify yourself as a carrot. So people know.
Yeah, well, Photoshop, we'll take your sculpture and grotesquely put this horrible version of my face on it.
There you go.
And it'll be the most hideous thing. All of us come out the worse. It's a desecration of your art and every yeah, it's just terrible.
That word you use, grotesque, I think that is actually like a good word to describe your work, but I also feel your work is very like, it's bizarre and adorable.
Oh, okay, thank you.
And yeah, it's weird, which is great. And we love that. Like, you're this like creative of striped tentacles and pumpkin crafts and weird shit. Like so we don't see that anywhere else. And I want to ask you, what are you looking for, like, for your branding? Like, is that why you're trying to communicate to your fans? Is this like a good explanation from my part? I don't know if I'm making myself weird. I'm actually kind of like thinking.
It's not. Yeah, I get that a lot. I guess, I mean, I'm not really looking for any sort of description myself when I put it out. So I'm not trying to make anything grotesque or trying to make anything typically cute. But sometimes it does fall in those categories. It's just, I guess, right. You know, when you start out making things, you get your inspirations from things you like, and then it goes into you, and then it sort of funnels out. So you'll get like trickles of whatever you've been watching or you're inspired by. But at this point, I'm just making things for reasons I don't even know, which is kind of interesting. And so it's like, I'm not really sure why I made this potato. And then it kind of tells me why I did it months later. And it really stems from like playing with my kid, like this latest like series, if you will call it, of like all these like odd toys that I've been making are pretty much because I sit and play with toys with my kid. And when I'm doing that, I come up with ideas, and he has this little like grocery set with cut limes and little lemons and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, and I picked it up and I was like, this is a great idea for like a wheel, this little line, like I'm going to incorporate it into this carrot. And, you know, I'm making a carrot, and then he's watching Ghostbusters, and he's watching, what's his name? Who's that fucking marshmallow?
That's quality parenting right there.
I know, right?
Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Yeah, so he's watching Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. And then the next, you know, I'm sculpting this carrot, and the face winds up looking like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
The face.
So like all these little things that, I think
it's funny. I didn't pick up on that. That's great.
But in the initial sketch, it looked nothing like that. So it's like, you know, living your life and doing things that don't really pertain to your work is where you get most of the inspiration for your work, I think.
Right.
I definitely beat that drum a lot. I meet young composers all the time. And literally the number one advice I always give them when they say, you know, just broadly, what should I do, you know, sometimes it's very open-ended where they kind of don't really know what's next. And I always say, go live a life, go like that. The music has to come from somewhere. And if all of your knowledge of your music is basically riffing on music that you've heard, you're kind of in a feedback loop. You're not really drawing from external sources, but all the music you love likely was, you know, it's stories like what you just told. It's people who, you know, like there's a famous example of John Williams, you know, probably the most famous composer alive and among in all history, thanks to the movies. He was married up until the mid 70s, and then his wife died. And he has spoken about like that wildly altered his sense of purpose as a composer. And so much of his writing became targeted about sort of meaningful living when he was confronted by how fragile life is. And he literally, his wife died way, you know, they were in their late 30s, early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And And so it's, you know, it's obviously not something he sought out, but it's an example of like where it's clarifying that that's a big part of, especially in that time period, where his music was coming from. And it's not just, oh, I studied Beethoven and now I kind of want to put my spin on it. It's like he's actually sort of absorbing the world around him and it's passing through that filter. But it's freaking tough because so many people, especially when they're just starting and they're hungry and they don't know what to do, it's like, no, but I need work. So how do I get work? And so they spend all their time obsessing over that question and forgetting to like the time, those hours in between, that is where all the ideas are actually going to come from. I love how it's so very literal in your case of like, I like this toy. I wonder if there's a manifestation of this toy as a wheel on my carrot.
Yeah.
That was actually something. It was something I was going to ask as well. Like, how much of your kid's point of view passed through you? Like, how much influence you have from him?
Oh, a lot, definitely. And I think, I guess just the experience of having a kid and, you know, a family just kind of changes your priorities as well. And a lot of the stuff I did before this was very like sort of preservation pieces for about my dog, because I lost the dog and family members and stuff like that. So
I love that. I love the caterpillar.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Like even something like that is like, there's meaning behind it, but there's also just a ridiculous aspect. Like, I wonder what he'd look like.
I know.
You know, and like, let's just do it. Yes. So, you know.
Has that always been how you operate? Like, is this something you've kind of fallen into as a pattern? Or if we went back to stuff you were making as a teenager, would it have that same kind of, you know, impetus and reflection of whatever was going on around you?
Probably subconsciously, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really creating like this until, you know, like 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't even know how to, I thought I didn't know how to sculpt. That's what I'm trying to say.
What?
Yeah, well, because I was doing commercials. I was directing like 2D animations and stuff like that. So that's what I went to school for. And I didn't, you know, I appreciated art, obviously. And, you know, you look at a piece of art and you feel a certain way. So I was collecting art and I was using... Well, somebody's calling me. Let me decline that. I was using the money I was making from working on commercials to like commission artists to like make sculptures and stuff. So I was like accumulating a nice collection of art. And I was going to art gallery, going to shows. And then one day, an artist, Chet Czar, you know, Chet Czar, he's got a podcast, The Dark Art Society. He wrote me and he said, hey, do you want to be in a sculpture show? And it had all these great artists. And I was like, I have no idea how to sculpt. But I said, yeah, sure. So I just sort of like said yes, even though I had no idea. And forced
what myself. Prompted him to make that offer without you having some kind of work to show for it? That's a pretty big leap on his part, yeah. Right?
Right. So it wasn't like I had absolutely nothing.
Turns out he was really high off his ass.
Yeah. And just passed along by and saying, this guy. I had a sculpture of a pumpkin crab, which was like a little, my first character I ever like drew up. But somebody else sculpted it and printed it and manufactured it. So that like little line of characters, he saw that. And then I guess assumed sculpted it, which I didn't. Mm. And then wrote me. It was like, oh. So I had to sort of force myself to like sculpt within like a month. And I didn't think anything was going to come from it. There was 100 artists in the show. I sculpted my dog and a little Sergeant Pepper's outfit because I really loved this.
Oh, I love that too.
Yeah. And
he has so many variations of his dog, like the three-headed dog as well, the purple with the heart. Also, I remember that one.
Yeah.
So cool.
I made it for him, and he didn't care for it. He just looked at it, and he said, what the hell is this?
They're very tough to impress. You can see Canvas in the background right now is pretty like, yeah, to this whole operation.
Yeah.
But so did that mean that you – was that like a lightning bolt? Like, oh my God, I need to change my whole life in what I'm pursuing. I mean, obviously you still do quite a lot of commercial work. And I know that you have to kind of swing back and forth in a certain sense between personal projects and commercial projects. But was that a moment? Yeah. It's the way you set it up. It sounds like a kind of light bulb. Oh my God, I should be a sculptor.
Copro Gallery gave me a solo show for I guess my debut solo show. And I had 2 years to sort of put together a bunch of pieces while still working full time at a commercial studio in New York. And I was commuting 2 hours there, 2 hours back. So I was coming up with a lot of ideas like on the train. And then I decided to film one of them, which was this piece called The Scarecrow. And, you know, we scored original music for it and put together a tiny little film about this one particular piece. And I think that the amount of traction I was getting from just those viewers, I think that really sparked something, because then I had designer toys of that character. I had merchandise of that character. So after that, it was a whole sort of, you know, a different ball.
That's how I got to know about you, your work. That was the first time. That was like 8 years ago or something like that. It was a long time ago. Yeah.
I feel old.
I didn't want you guys to talk about composing for some reason. It makes me curious.
Well, I what I love about that story you just told is, you know, it strikes me that one of the kind of hallmarks of a 21st century artist is that a lot of it is very interdisciplinary. That, you know, when you think of classical masters, especially in the world of fine arts, it tends to be a little bit like they did this thing. And yeah, there's occasional exceptions, or like you see about, you know, even into the 20th century, you know, like the famous Dali, you know, linking up with Disney and those kinds of things. But like, generally speaking, I think the cliche mental image that people have in their mind when they picture an artist is someone basically alone in a room. They actually probably picture a studio very much like the one we see that you're in right now. It's because it feels like this kind of mad scientist little hovel, you know? And but what I love is that it's actually very deceptive, because so much of what's interesting today is when people do things like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna make a sculpture, but I'm also gonna kind of make a film around it, or I'll make the behind the scenes of this painting. Like Angela might, you know, do digital art on the Procreate, where on the like iPad, where it's essentially filming, it's essentially documenting the whole process, and you have this very simple little time lapse of the whole thing from beginning to end baked into the piece, so that's part of the finished product now, and it's almost like filmmaking of a sort. And I think that's increasingly common, and I love that. But I don't know where that came from, and I don't know, and it's one of those where I don't know how artists even learn that, but it just seems like that's one of the things that there's very few, just like a painter or a sculptor solely of note, it would feel like today. It's almost always, at least in my limited view, someone who's doing that in tandem with something else, or they're just exactly as with your Scarecrow piece, that it's really not just limited to the piece. There's a whole world around it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting. And it makes me wonder, were you drawing inspiration for that from somewhere? Like, were you looking at that and going, like, oh, I noticed someone else did a thing that kind of along this line, and what if I took that and ran with it, or whatnot? Or did you just pure spontaneous, like off the cuff?
Yeah. I at this point, this when I first started this, which was 2014, when I started sculpting that character and filming it. And I was filming that for 2 years, that particular piece.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I, you know, just sort of had a camera as I was sculpting, and I didn't see any other like sculpting videos at the time. I don't think there was really that many. It wasn't like a thing. And it was just something that I just felt to document. I don't know if for the viewers that can't see, I'm holding Coraline's head from the film Coraline.
Oh,
this was the painted maquette from the film. And I was working at Aardman, Nathan Love, and you know, they do stop motion too. So like, I remember seeing Coraline and then seeing a making of, and then seeing a Leica auction. So you have these three things. You have a movie, you have a making of video, and then you have an auction, and they're auctioning off these heads and these props from the film. And then those props have value because we saw the making of and we saw the film. I'm bringing this up, it was on my shelf over here, is because I saw that and I thought that was an interesting sort of three-step process. And I guess subconsciously, in a way, I wanted to kind of reverse that, where you have a sculpture and then you have a making of, and then possibly there's more of a world to it. So
right.
as I was sculpting, I was filming to sort of put this epic thing together. And then yada, yada, yada. There's a bunch of merch.
Wow.
So I guess it, you know, it's some in some sense, it did work for that. There was a freaking 5-story scarecrow in Italy 2 years ago walking down the street. And
what?
People have him tattooed on him. Yeah, it was bizarre.
Wow, tattoos also. That's yeah. quite the I hadn't known about that.
Yeah, a bunch of everyone has
lengths of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So he's done his thing, and you know, I try to have other characters, but it's very difficult to make like films now. It takes like years just to make one thing, even as small as they are, because it's all me, like, and I get caught up on the animation side of it. Sort of working with composers, trying to get like the right sound of it and all that.
And it's not even like it's regular filmmaking, it's stop motion. That's why it's so hard to do.
Yeah, some of them are stop motion. Some are regular, just like film, and you'll see me working. But some are like I will make the piece in stop motion. So I'll click it. This is before I had a remote. I was clicking the shutter with my toe.
Oh my god.
I would have to be in the shot too. So I'm like sculpting in the shot, hitting it with my toe and then moving myself, also trying to sculpt.
Oh, that brings me back to when I used to do cosplay and I didn't have like a, for the selfie. So you have to do whatever it takes to have the perfect photo with, you know, the costume on. But yeah, the
so
foot.
Brutal.
It works.
Yeah, I know
so.
That.
But yeah, very painstaking.
Amazing.
Yeah. But working with you, me too.
Wow.
Is there like a grand version of that is like your dream? Is there a feature version of that even though the way you're describing it would require essentially a different process because otherwise it would take the entire rest of your life to make. But I'm curious if there's sort of lurking in your back of the head, like the kind of, you know, the grand version.
Yeah, I think, what I'm working on right now has been sort of, in my head, the grand version of process videos. It's taking me like 2.5 years to film this one potato process video, but it, you know, incorporates visuals. It has instructional shots where you could sort of learn from it. So that's the main thing I want to showcase is like, yeah, like
that's cool.
For younger artists that have no idea what I'm doing or how to make something like this, if you watch this, you know, you're entertained, but you could also learn from it. You could also buy the exact materials I have and make something exactly like this. So I want to showcase that. And this new one has like a little bit of comedy. I have a Deep Roy from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, a bunch of other films. He's in the film. And there's this set. It's going to be fun, but it's almost done. So that will be the one.
How far off is that likely to be?
I think in August.
All right.
Nice.
Yeah. It still has
pretty close.
Yeah.
Does that mean that it'll be give or take 3 years by the time you're done with it?
Maybe. Yeah. There's like some shots in there that were 2 years from 2 years ago. And there's a shot actually where like I play the scientist toy maker. He's in a laboratory and he's looking through sketches because his boss told him, you know, this toy sucks. You have to come up with a new toy. So he's, you know, coming up with all these sketches, and one of the sketches was a really bad idea, which was a carrot foot. So it was intentionally like a shit idea. It didn't have like wheels, like limes or anything, but like this was a sketch from like 2 years ago. And then he takes it and he crumbles it up and he like throws it. And the other day I was like, I want to make like a new piece. And I was like, oh, what about that like really shitty idea of that carrot foot? Like that idea fucking sucks. Let's do that. And as I'm doing it, it's like morphed itself by living, you know, vicariously through my son. So,
amazing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, you needed the child's toys to figure out
exactly
what was missing.
Yeah,
yeah, that's so funny. There's every now and again, there's a lot of stories from my neck of the woods of things like that. There was in the late '80s, there was a movie called Alien Nation that they subsequently made a sort of cheesy TV show out of as well. That was, I can't even remember the premise, but it was effectively like aliens land and on Earth and basically have to like integrate into society, and it's not a graceful transition. And the movie My all-time hero, in fact, this here is a painting of him that Angela made. His name is Jerry Goldsmith. He did a million huge movies, most famously five of the Star Trek films, and Planet of the Apes and Alien and a bunch of stuff. He scored this movie, Alienation, and they fired him. They threw out his score, and it was all like in the 80s, he was very experimental with sort of analog synths and the rise of like Moogs and keyboard synths and DX7s and all these things that were very hip at the time. And so he did a few scores that were not orchestral, which was his background. He did like pure synth scores, and Alien Nation was one of them. And it's not particularly great. It's not a big shock that he got fired, but there's this one melody from it that that he always liked, and then later got hired to do the Sean Connery movie called The Russia House. And it's like this old classic sort of almost borderline Chinatown-esque, which he also scored, jazz score featuring Branford Marsalis on these big lush saxophone solos. And he just took a melody from his rejected score to Alienation and just straight up was like, well, they fired me, so screw it. I'm just using this again. And wrote, and it ended up being like one of the most beautiful things he ever wrote. And if you go back and you listen to the original, that's like the synth keyboard version, it sounds so a sketch at best. But it was always one of those, like as a kid, when I heard this idea that somebody could kind of like go thumbing through their old stuff and go, actually, there might be something there. I ought to like, why did I throw that away? Or why did someone else in this case throw that away? But there's other stories with him like that as well, of kind of pawing through the old. But I never had that. Just,
yeah.
No,
you
like
never recycle
I,
any idea.
No, like I have my sketchbook here, and it's and I have huh. I have years worth in this and others, and every time I go back and look at stuff, I go, oh, this is all terrible. Like this is. There's a very good reason why I moved on. Like it was a necessary part of the process to, you know, my really fucked up analogy is I think of it as like I have to vomit everything first so that I can reach the bile.
My God.
Like, but it's accurate. Like in this, you have to go through the horrible process of vomiting before you get to the thing you're actually after, which for some reason is bile, but it's the only analogy I can think of that
the perfect body.
It sort of portrays the process. And so I envy anyway, it's a long winded way of saying I envy being able to look at something old and go, hey, actually that was cool. Like that, what if this thing that was designed to be bad is actually not bad? And what if there could be something fun there or worthy and what for whatever reason. I don't think I've ever once had that experience.
Yeah. So say your stuff, you know, in the past is vomit and there's nothing really there. It sometimes, you know, I'll look back like 11 years ago and feel like, you know, something I did in college, even though it just sucked, something about it, there was like, it was a time where like I was listening to certain music and like the colors were like just giving me a certain vibe. And I'll have to go back and like put on whatever music I was listening to at that time and just try to like re-inspire myself to tap into like a year where I felt like I was giving like a certain sort of like feeling out. So I do that. Like I'll try to like go back and like remember like what did I used to do? Or cause like, you know, I'm making like a lot of like ugly stuff kind of not intentionally. And you know, I think that one
is very adorable.
Oh, thank you. But I don't like the color orange. And like my whole room is filled with like orange sculptures. And, you know, what I buy is like very colorful and like rainbow stuff. And that's the stuff I used to. So I try to like go back and figure out how I could make that stuff again. And I don't know. It's just it's hard.
But I did want to ask because you did actually tap onto something that I'm also very curious about of. Visual artists who use music as inspiration. And obviously that's like a big thing that catalyzed our initial kind of bond was I was writing music for her to use explicitly as, and we did this. I don't remember if we ever told you about the little thing that we did where I wrote a little piece for piano and she made a little pencil sketch based on it and then handed me the pencil sketch and I made a piece based on that, handed the new piece back to her. She made a new pencil sketch based on that. And we did this thing where each iteration was based on whatever the person just finished, basically. So it's like a game of telephone. And just to see where, you know, none of us is drawing from the outside world other than just your own baked in things that, you know, are subconscious. But you know, seeing how much something could kind of spin off into an unexpected direction, even though theoretically, it, like, if art was objective, it would never move this process. Because if she was truly inspired by the piece and there was some sense of objective connect, like one-to-one, then the only piece I could think to write based on that sketch would be writing the same exact piece again, if art was objective. Mm. Obviously, because it's not. It's really interesting how rapidly you move away from the source material despite deliberately not looking to anything from the outside world. So, long-winded way of saying, because that's something that's always interesting to us, is this collision of art and of like visuals and music and how they might talk to each other. You mentioned listening to music to get back into a headspace that you'd kind of somehow detached from or forgotten even how to get into. Is that normal for you? Is music one of those ways to kind of like,
oh yeah,
sort of reboot your brain?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And this might be something you might be interested in. I don't really play video games. I used to when I was a kid.
Shame.
But there's one thing that, well, I had a system and then somebody robbed my house and multiple times. Good friend. So I don't have any system. But when I last game I was playing, I
they think still sell like them actually. Funny, just like little trivia for you to keep in the back of your mind.
I have no time. My kid actually just started playing 2 days ago, started playing Mario 64, which we do have. That's the only console end game we have. Well, but Wind Waker, Zelda Wind Waker was like the last game I played and when I had something. So I always like, there's like a 10-hour loop of the Wind Waker, you know, he's out to sea. And for some reason, like that loop, it just, maybe it's the timing of it. It just feels like it gets me like right in like this weird mood where like I can fully concentrate. And I think it has to do with like somewhat of the loop. Like it's timed like perfectly that like, I don't like have any ADD or I'm not like looking around, like it'll just like zombify me and I'll just start working.
Oh my God.
So and crazy. It's just the weirdest thing. And I usually listen to like somber, like Nick Drake, like depressing 70s stuff. But for some reason I always put on the Wind Waker song 10 hours. And yeah.
That's very specific. Yeah, you're not alone there. I see that all the time, like on Twitter and stuff where people talk about especially the 10-hour versions of things. That's very much become a thing. And video game music seems to have an outsized, like I don't see 10-hour Stairway to Heavens, you know, like it'll be literally, it'll be that. It'll be Zelda or Mario or more recent games, the 10-hour version. Mm-hmm. And I get people request that of me sometimes where I just think, it always is hard for me to understand how that could possibly be appealing. But in your case, like a thing that kind of makes you focus. I hadn't really thought of it that way because obviously I can't relate to this. It's not like I can put on music in order to focus on writing music.
Right.
So I have no equivalent to this.
Right.
I need ideally silence. Yeah. And so, but sometimes silence is actually a problem. Like I will every now and again, if I'm not doing really like mixing and things that I really have to listen with maximum focus to because I'm finalizing a thing. If I'm writing or if I'm sketching or if I'm like iterating or I'm improving or sometimes like if I'm scoring a project and the director will give me feedback and I know what to do in a kind of intellectual way, sometimes I'll put on podcasts and while I'm dealing with the music, even though theoretically that's adding noise, but it can have a similar effect. And I constantly pause it because I constantly need to have silence. But so it'll take me, someone will send me like a 1 hour podcast and 2 weeks later I'll have listened to it because I took 101-minute bites out of it. But not that math works, but so yeah, anyway, I'm always, it's just endlessly fascinating how people use music. So we sometimes do like a album of the day kind of for fun on here. So we will make the Zelda Wind Waker.
Oh my god!
10 hour is our album.
Because this was gonna be my next question. We do an album of the day at the end of each episode, and I want Jim to give the, you know, we want to give you the honor to choose the album of the day.
What an honor it is, too.
Wow, the album of the day. Well, my favorite is Nick Drake, Pink Moon. It's not really
excellent.
Yeah. That's the album of the
well,
day.
Well, I think that's a very good choice, but your actual choice is clearly the 10-hour.
What I really mean to say is the 10-hour.
Not biased. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
Well, there's something like adventurous about it, and when I was playing it at the time, I was just a introverted fat kid who didn't really go out, and it's a song where like you're sailing in a boat. And there was something like, the whole world is in front of you. So like that sort of feeling at the time, to tap into that, I don't know. I know it's corny as hell.
No, that's legit, man.
No, shut up. That is very nice.
That's the thing. Yeah. That's been one of those unique things about video games that non-gamers have never quite been able to grasp, is that because you'll be looking at something that's, like 8-bit pixel art with a very limited color palette. The music is coming through, 8-bit chip tunes, which is the classic, would be basically two different pitch generators and then a noise generator, which would be your drums. So that's where you get melody, bass, and some very simple rhythmic pattern. But because you are leaning into the experience and you're like, oh, I remember I heard this thing right as I finally solved this puzzle and, I rescued the princess. And like at 7 years old, that hit me like a ton of bricks. People look at it, they look at it on YouTube of Capture, and they're like, how on earth is this one of your seminal childhood experience? They just think you're absolutely insane. And now, fortunately, we're at a point where, all those folks who grew up having those experiences are adults and don't question it increasingly. Like, we're generationally aging out the skeptics of this art form. But yeah, it is you have to have experienced it. And what you just described is a perfect example of how these things can affect you.
I would love, honestly, I extend you the invitation to come over and play Journey because I'm curious about your take on it.
Journey, what is it?
I'll leave it to you.
No, it's actually, I actually love the idea of not saying anything. Journey is a game I worked on that sort of, my version of the Scarecrow, as it were. It's a thing that that's I did hilarious. That wildly changed the direction of my career. It's a game that really, really heavily my career would not resemble itself if I'd not had the great luck of working on that game. But I actually love this proposal. I love the idea of, it's also an extremely visual game. And so it's always fascinating to get an artist, someone who spends all their time sort of thinking visually, or at least predominantly that way. I think it would be a wonderful thing to get a real time reaction. I will say no more about it. And I think that's a great idea. We should absolutely have a.
It's super quick. It's like a 2 hour,
2 hours
like,
max.
It's like a movie.
It's meant to be feature length, a single sitting. The analogy at the time when we were working on it was, if you think of most games as novels that you kind of pick up and put down and pick up and put down, this game very much aspired to a poem that if you read half of a poem and then come back to it later, you're never going to kind of get it. It's not meant for that. Yeah. It's meant as a concentrated one dose, one sitting. And so it's meant to be kind of bite-size as games go as a result. Wow. Took 3 years to do, but it takes 90 minutes to play.
Well, that's awesome. It sounds really intense. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Also, I just want to show off my little gym original here.
I can't see you guys. You've been frozen for a good.
Oh, really?
Oh my god.
Oh well, you're absolutely. You're pantomiming it very effectively.
Yeah, you're okay. You're fine. Well, one I'm showing off anyway.
Was it a milk?
Yeah. My cup of milk.
Very nice.
Yeah,
it's so good. Well, I have to run, I'm afraid, but I really appreciate you hanging with us, man. And it's really fun to get just totally different walk of life as an artist. Sort of similar, but really mostly different. So, completely. Really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim. Thank you, everybody, for listening and for watching.
Goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
Awesome.